Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, where we were joined by the fantastic Angela Barnes.
Yeah, she's absolutely amazing. She's been on Fish before. I didn't get to be on the show with her, so I was very excited to sit down with her. She's full of facts, she's full of jokes, and she's full of tour. She's on tour now.
She's on tour twice, in fact. Yes. She is doing her own tour, which is called Angst, yeah. And she is also touring with a British iconic series.
That's right, The Archers. Anyone who listens to Radio 4 will know that show and no other show. And Andy's The Naked Week is available as well. She's doing a live version of that. So if you go online, put in The Archers Tour, you'll find dates for that. But go see Angst. She's a brilliant stand-up. She's on tour right now. So on the 11th of April, she's going to be in Chesham. And then there's places like Hastings and Hemel Hempstead and Ivy Bridge, Hereford. A lot of these shows are nearly sold out. So get your tickets now.
Hemel Hempstead is where all the hamsters live that used to live in Hemel Hempstead, isn't it?
Oh, yes. That's an interesting fact. We should do that on the show. Or we should pronounce places properly. If you want to go get those tickets, go to angelabarnescomedy.co.uk and go see her live now.
One more thing, do join Clubfish. Go to patreon.com/clubfish if you want to get involved with that community. Loads of extra stuff, merch, bonus material. You know all about it. If you don't know about it, go to patreon.com/clubfish and you will find out more there.
Okay, on with the podcast.
On with the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with James Harkin, Andrew Hunter-Murray, and Angela Barnes. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in a particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Angela.
Okay, so my fact is that the number four is orange and a lot kinder than number five, which has an attitude problem.
Wow, are we talking about number blocks?
Yes, we are. I don't have children, so I don't know what you're talking about there, but I'm assuming that's a CBBS reference.
Yeah, yeah.
Four is orange and
four
it's kind.
Four is orange and it's kind, right. But number five is quite aggressive and has an attitude problem.
Okay, so what are you talking about?
Should I tell you what we're talking about? Okay. I'm talking about synesthesia.
Oh, yeah.
So you may have heard of synesthesia. I'm a synesthete. So I was diagnosed with synesthesia when I was 19 at university. And I've got several types, but the main one is grapheme colour synesthesia.
Ooh.
So that means that numbers, letters, days of the week, any abstract concepts have a colour.
Okay.
And I always say, it doesn't mean I see auras. I know I'm from Brighton, but I'm not that person. It's just, it's hard to explain when you are a synesthete, yeah. Because the reason I didn't know I had it till I was 19 is because we all just sort of assume everyone's brain works broadly the same as ours.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I don't understand how you don't have colours.
Can I ask a question?
Things. You may.
You have a sheet of paper in front of you.
I do.
It's black and white.
Yes.
When you look at that, is it like they're coloured in the letters? Or is
no.
it more of a...
So some people have a sort of synesthesia which is projected, mm-hmm. they call it. So they do exactly that. It sort of changes colour when yeah. they look at it. Yeah. For me, it's very internal. So it's in my mind's eye, if you like, for want of a better word.
Yes.
So I'm currently part of a study at Sussex University. There's Professor Julia Simner at Sussex Uni, and she specialises in perception and synesthesia. And I wrote to her a couple of years ago because when I think, every thought I have is in a physical location from the real world. Yeah. So when I think about the number four, it's always in the sky,
yeah.
but it's orange. So it's sort of floating wow. orange in the sky. Wow. And so I contacted her to say, is this a form of synesthesia? And she said, well, I've never heard of it, but let's do a study. And so they found a handful of people that seemed to experience the same thing. And so she's studying it. She's calling it conception location synesthesia right. is what she's calling it. But also, have you heard of Adam Zeman? So he's the man yeah. who came up with the word aphantasia
okay.
for people who have no internal images.
Like me.
Hello.
Like, oh, do you have right. aphantasia? Yeah, yeah. So Julia's very interested in that as well.
What okay. what a sandwich I'm sitting in here. In between synesthesia
I've got all
and
the
aphantasia.
Images that you don't have yeah, in my yeah. brain, basically.
It feels a bit greedy, really, actually, I'll be honest.
Well, there was a massive coincidence. So it's about 2 years ago, I contacted Julia. And around the same time, Adam Zeman contacted her and said, I've had someone get in touch to describe this phenomenon about location when they're thinking. And she said, oh, that must be Angela. She contacted me as well. And he said, no, it's someone else entirely.
Ah.
And it just happened to be within the same 2 weeks. So they're now both doing studies on
telekinesis.
This, on Ebonia. Wow. With that.
It's morphic resonance, I think.
Yeah, actually. Thank you.
He's actually calling it, he's calling it topophantasia, which makes sense.
Yeah. So there is a thing of, I mean, I'm not synesthesiatical. Synesthesiatical. I don't have aphantasia, but I do have the, I'm sure lots of people have the location specific, a sensory thing triggers a spatial memory.
Uh-huh.
So if I smell green chilies roasting, I'm in New Mexico and it's autumn.
Yes.
You know? So that's
very linked to memory. So that's really common that when we smell something, but the thing with synesthesia is there isn't a link.
You've just described memory, Andy.
No.
Angela's politely saying.
It's a really common thing. So for me, it's if I smell baked beans cooking, I'm in my school canteen.
Andy.
That's not what I meant.
What I'm trying to say is it triggers a specific,
like
a specific sensation triggers a really specific memory.
Proustian.
Yeah.
So
Proustian.
What they think is with people with synesthesia is, there's lots of theories and they don't know exactly what causes synesthesia. They have worked out that it's hereditary and that it's to do with the X chromosome. But what they think happens is that when you're a child, before you acquire language, you obviously have to interpret the world around you in a different way without words. And so you have this extra white matter, extra connections in your brain to different parts of your brain. And that in most people, they sort of get pruned away as you don't need them anymore.
Right.
And then, but with people with synesthesia, those connections don't get pruned, they stay.
Uh-huh.
And so what it means is that you get a sort of an odd reaction to a stimulus, and by odd I just mean one that isn't typical. So for someone with synesthesia, a part of my brain gets triggered when I see a certain letter or I hear something or whatever that wouldn't normally be triggered in that situation. And so it's just it's a hyper connected brain. That's what they call it. And so there's lots of things that go with it, like misophonia, misokinesia, all these things people with synesthesia tend to.
So you hate it when people are chewing next to you?
I hate it when people are chewing next to me. I have really strong misophonia.
Synesthesiatical.
you can have misophonia. It's really.
What about people putting their feet on the seats on the train? Is that a special power that I have to find that annoying?
I think you're just a bit old man.
I don't think it could be that bad because I'm very young.
You should be. Everyone should be angry with people putting their feet on. Okay. I think that's perfect. But misokinesia is something that, again, I had a meeting with Julia a couple of months ago just to sort of see how the study was going and stuff, because I'm hoping to write a book about it. And she told me about misokinesia, which really made me go, oh, yes, I have that. My husband is what I'd call a jiggler, one of those people who just doesn't stop moving constantly.
Oh, yeah.
If I can see a part of his body moving out the corner of my eye, it drives me insane.
Yeah.
Like, if I can just see a movement, and they call it misokinesia. And she told me, which made me feel better about it, it might make you feel better about your misophonia, is that apparently it's the salience network in your brain which is activated when you have misophonia. And it is the same reaction, basically, she described it to me, as if a bear had walked in the room.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's sort of that ancient part of your brain being triggered.
Is that right? I'm really interested, Angela. Okay, so that's the colours we talked about a little bit. But what is this about them having personality?
So that is something which is called ordinal linguistic personification.
Okay.
So some letters and numbers have personalities to people with synesthesia. So most of the numbers I find quite friendly, apart from number 5.
Sorry, quick question.
Yeah.
If there were a room of, say, 20 people who all had this particular type of synesthesia, would you all agree the colours? You've all got your own
all
separate...
got our own
Okay.
I think there are some trends, if you like, to some colours are picked more often, but they don't really know why.
Yeah.
So for example, the days of the week have very fixed colours for me. Most people, if you ask them what colour is Monday, will say blue.
Blue, yeah.
Because of the Blue Monday association.
Yeah.
So you can predict quite often what people will say.
Yeah.
But in synesthetes, they're random.
And there's another, which I find amazing. I didn't know about all these varieties.
There's over 150 types of synesthesia that they know of now.
So the one I love most is mirror touch synesthesia, which is where you feel what someone else feels if you see it happening to them. And there are a couple of amazing case studies. There's a woman called Carolyn. She's a massage therapist, and she remembers very clearly being 3 years old, seeing, I think, a dog break its leg, and she immediately felt blinding pain in, I guess, one of her rear or front leg. I guess one of her legs. One of her legs. And she felt enormous pain. So she can't watch action movies because she just feels so much what's going on. But she's a massage therapist, so her job is terrific because it feels like she's constantly being rubbed.
That's
amazing. Really, she's massaging herself so, as she does
it
the...
It feels so nice.
I hope she doesn't make the noises. That'd be off-putting, wouldn't it?
And there's one other guy, a doctor called Joel Salinas, and he's a doctor. And this is a big problem in his line of work because if he sees...
He's not a surgeon.
He saw someone having a cardiac arrest and he felt... very, you know, obviously you don't feel exactly what they do, but you feel very strongly. The patient died and he did not. So clearly there is a...
That would be unfortunate.
Sometimes they get... I know people with mirror synesthesia get like just a tingling sensation. So if they see someone hurt their arm, they'll get like a tingling in their arm or...
Okay.
Yeah, so it's not always a complete mirror, but still in the same area.
I think I have the opposite of that because I took my daughter to nursery this morning and she fell off a scooter and got a little scrape on her knee and I was like, come on, it doesn't hurt.
That's called being an 80s dad. I think you
But we do. I think we all experience, like, if you want to picture the experience of it, if you ever see someone kicked really hard in the genitals, that involuntary, you do yourself. That must be what it feels like for people all the time.
More so,
The only way I found out I had it is I was doing linguistics at Sussex University. And there was a lecturer, Larry Trask, who's sadly no longer with us, but he did a lecture about language acquisition in children. And they were talking about this theory that, well, I said earlier, you know, the connections die out and then these people can... And I remember sitting in that lecture going, but everyone has colours, what are you talking about? Mm. And then I came home and I told my dad first and he said, well, surely everyone has... I was like, okay, well, now I can see there's a hereditary line. Yeah. And then when I told my mum, she said, oh, that explains why you used to get so angry at the magnetic letters when you were a kid. Because they were the wrong colour.
Oh. There was a study in 2013 that looked at people in America with synesthesia and found that a lot of them associated the same colours with letters as those magnetic letters.
Right.
And a lot of people kind of pointed at that as saying, well, this is... it's just made up, isn't it? It's just like the only reason you think A is red is because you had these magnets and you thought A is red.
Right.
So James Wanaton at the UK Synesthesia Association is quite annoyed by it. And he says it's really annoying that people try and explain it away. Mm. But actually, it is interesting because these colours, are they always the same? Like you say, they're different for everyone.
Yeah.
But for you in particular, are your colours always, have they been the same your whole life? Because they do change for some people.
So this is a really interesting point because up until recently, consistency was a way of sort of confirming whether someone had synesthesia. So what you would do the test and then 6 months later you do it again and then you do it again. But the main reason they did that was because there have been periods in time when being a synesthete has been fashionable. And so because lots of people self-identified as synesthetes who weren't synesthetes, it was very difficult to do studies on synesthetes. So the way they did it was to use this consistency idea. Yeah. But it doesn't necessarily mean that if it's not consistent, you're not a synesthete.
Right.
It just means if it isn't consistent, then you definitely are.
Yeah, I read a study of a woman just known as AB who sees colours when she hears music. It's a different tones have different colours, right? But then the paper said to say she had a series of unfortunate events would be an understatement. As a teenager, she sustained several concussions, had migraines, contracted viral meningitis, and was struck by lightning.
Oh my God. Wow. And she's born on a Friday the 13th.
Bad luck, isn't it? But every time one of these things happened, like the colours changed.
Oh.
But by the end, they all came back. Mm. So it would like change and then it would come back and then it would change and then come back.
Mm. So I find, like, I do a lot of crosswords. I love cryptic crosswords and word puzzles and things. And particularly, I don't know if you know the spelling bee on New York Times. Some days can't do it because the letter is so arrogant in the middle that I just go, I can't do it.
That's my excuse when I don't manage to do a crossword as well. I'm sorry, just not
please
today.
Don't review any of our books, Angela, in case.
What is the most arrogant letter? I've got three, A-H-M, but what is your most...
Wow.
It took me a minute, but I got those letters. The most arrogant letter is probably X.
Yeah.
It's very, snobby.
Interesting.
You know, it thinks
keeps himself to himself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so you've got grapheme colour. which is your type of synesthesia. So other people who supposedly had it was Richard Feynman, the great physicist, who used to see the equations in various different colors as he was writing them. Vladimir Nabokov also had that. And then there's another one which is called chromesthesia, which is where you pair color with sound. And a lot of musicians have this. So supposedly, I mean, you get these lists online. And so some of these might have just made it through anecdotally, but aren't necessarily true. But Stevie Wonder supposedly has it. So he sees color when he's writing songs. Beyonce has it. Charlie XCX. Jimi Hendrix had it, and apparently there was a chord which is known as the Hendrix chord, but it's also the purple chord because he would see purple when he wrote it, and the song Purple Haze is the haze, and it's that chord is used a lot in that song.
Very nice.
This is the one I find most fascinating that I don't experience: lexical gustatory, where people hear words and taste certain tastes. So they might hear a trigger word and they suddenly can taste licorice or strawberry.
So the guy, who is it? Was it you, James, who mentioned James Wannerton, the president of the UK Synesthesia Association? He has this and he visited every tube, overground and Docklands Light Railway station to find out what they tasted like.
Oh, nice. He sounds like one of us. Yeah.
Tottenham Court Road, sausage and egg, King's Cross, rich fruitcake, and he produced a tube map with the flavours. It's really good.
That's really good.
That's sort of the one I wish I had. Cool one.
There are sexual synesthetes.
I will say, I don't mind saying this on air, orgasms have colours. So depending on intensity it's usually through the red spectrum. So it's usually red or orange. So I always say my husband knows it's been a good night if he says, how was it for you? And I say burnt umber.
Wow. Well, that's very Farrow and Ball as well. Elephant's breath.
Very boutique.
Wow.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is Andy.
My fact is, in 1577, there was only one man in England permitted to touch the Queen.
The king?
Yeah. No.
King at the time. So we're on Queen Elizabeth I.
Okay.
Who, for international listeners, kind of a big deal.
The Virgin Queen.
Did she ever see burnt umber? We don't know.
Her hair was quite burnt umber.
That was, So I went to a gallery recently, which was it's in South London. It's in Greenwich, and they have a thing called the Queen's Gallery there. It's amazing, lots of amazing artworks. And there was one portrait of a courtier from the 16th century who was called Richard Drake. And the little information panel said this guy was the only person permitted to touch the Queen, and it's because he was the master of the Queen's horse. So helping her mount onto her horse, that kind of thing. Wow. And I think he was a cousin of Francis Drake.
I was going to say, was he related to Francis Drake?
Yeah. So they were quite a posh family and they had all sorts of connections and, built all sorts of
industries. How did he sort of, go on all fours so she could walk on his back?
That was it. That was exactly it.
Really? Yeah.
No, he would throw her on. It was amazing.
Do you do the hand thing where you stand on a hand?
Yeah, imagine giving the Queen a leg.
It must be that.
I think that is the classic.
I could absolutely imagine it being him on all fours. And she steps on
true.
His back.
That's true. Yeah.
Or piggyback.
Shoulder ride, I think.
Shoulder ride.
Shoulder ride over to the horse, and then
that's
like
nice.
She's at transfer. A gig.
Yeah.
Is it only me who, whenever they think of Elizabeth I, only has Miranda Richardson?
Queenie.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
But we've never really spoken about it before, and she was the most interesting woman and monarch, and just crazy. The last Tudor. That's interesting, end of a house, because she died without heirs, so obviously the whole royal system changes after her, and we get James I of Scotland in as king next. But
daughter of Henry VIII.
Of Henry VIII. Not expected to become queen at all because she was the daughter of Anne Boleyn.
Yeah.
So her dad beheaded her mum. Yeah. I mean,
that's some therapy sessions there, isn't it?
Yeah.
And also, she was never legitimised, was she, in law? Like, Henry VIII changed the succession laws so that she could succeed, but he never officially changed it. He sort of declared it. Right. So there was, I think throughout her reign, there were questions on her legitimacy.
Yeah. Wow. How interesting. Because her father, Henry VIII, obviously lots of wives, and then Anne Boleyn was the second wife, and with his third wife, Jane Seymour, he had Edward VI, who was a son, so became heir. But then Edward VI died after only a few years on the throne. Then there was some Mary, Queen Catholic. all the religious stuff. But this, so her childhood was crazy because she grew up in very, very rich circumstances. And then when her mother was executed, when she was under 3 years old, it all changed and it was all taken away. And supposedly, after Anne Boleyn was beheaded, her mother, the young Elizabeth asked her governor, "Why, governor, how happened yesterday, Lady Princess, and today but Lady Elizabeth?" Supposedly, this is when she was 2 years and 8 months. Mm. Which I find a bit...
That's like those people on Facebook, isn't it? You'll never guess what little Tommy said this morning. No, he didn't.
Exactly.
Interesting. I was looking at some other people in Queen Elizabeth's court. So there was one of her favourites was a woman called Lettuce Knollys. And Lettuce was in Queen Elizabeth's court for 15 to 20 years. Which is 150 times longer than Liz Truss was prime minister. But she was like one of her absolute favourites. And then she married Robert Dudley in secret. And Robert Dudley was the bloke who Queen Elizabeth really fancied. And when she married this guy, she was out. Queen Elizabeth said, "I don't want to see you anymore."
But he was also, I think, the master of the horse just before Richard Drake.
Is that so?
He served a term. So he would have, I don't know if he had the same privileges of being the only man to be able to touch her.
He must have been.
He certainly touched her emotionally, Dan.
Did Lettuce, was she, wasn't executed or anything?
She wasn't executed.
We didn't end up with the head of Lettuce. Okay.
Oh, I can't believe I walked straight into that one.
I had to really force march my way into that.
Oh my god.
We actually know a descendant of Lettuce.
Do we?
I think the four of us must know this descendant of Lettuce because we happen to know the 13 times great grandson
of Lettuce.
Do you know who it is?
It's not Widdicombe, is it?
It's Josh Widdicombe.
Yeah.
Is it?
Comedian Josh Widdicombe.
Was that from his
Who Do You Think You Are?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We still have, you call them equerries that look after the horses in the royal household. And the senior equerry to Queen Camilla is called Major Rob Treasure, which I don't think you should have them in the royal family.
It's a bit on the nose, isn't it?
Something's gone missing from the Tower of London. Okay, bring in Rob Treasure.
It's either going to be Paul Burrell or Rob Treasure.
And it was a big role, the Master of the Horses, back then. If you think about, you're in charge of the horses these days, you're just in charge of this sort of rich bit of your life, right? But back then, that's like looking after the cars. That was looking after the transport to war. That was looking after your main line of soldier for so many things.
Horses have manes, yes?
Yes.
And the main man.
That's what he should have been called.
Yeah.
Master of the horses. So back then, that was an incredibly important role. You were breeding, you were buying, you were purchasing. It was a type of army, wasn't it? It was a whole bit of the army.
Yeah.
So these days, less so. Now it's about maintenance. But still, horses very big within the world of the royals, at least up until Queen Elizabeth II, who, she used to make sure that she was at all the horse races
racing.
She owned so many horses. She was obsessed with how her horses were being bred. She had,
I feel like she won the Grand National or something.
Didn't she have a massive horse treadmill as well?
Remember,
she had a treadmill where 18 horses could exercise at the same time.
Wow.
Something impressive like that.
I once did an after dinner at the Guards Polo Club.
Ooh.
A spectacular piece of misbooking is the only way I could describe that. It was one of the worst.
Did they book you because your name is Barnes?
Maybe.
Was Andrew Stables not available?
I got there. This is a true story. So this was 15 years ago, so I was a brand new comedian and I didn't know to say no to something like that. And I turned up, and for a start, I went and I thought, what am I going to wear to this thing? It was black tie at Duke of Edinburgh's Polo Club.
Right.
And so I went and bought a dress from Debenhams, which I thought was good enough. And then I got there and went, this doesn't cut it at all. And anyway, I did the gig and it was, as expected, hard work. And then as I was leaving, a woman stopped me in the doorway. And she literally said to me, "I knew when I saw you arrive, you must be the entertainer."
Wow.
She went, "I knew you could have been married to a polo player, not with that hair." And then walked off.
What?
It was awful. Wow. But with the money I made from that gig, I went on holiday to Cuba. So
there we go.
Who got the last laugh?
Very nice. Yeah, just one.
What,
sorry,
a bunch of
they were. It was funny because I also did the thing that I now know you don't do at after dinners or corporates, but I was very green at the time. And that I sat and had dinner with them.
When you say you were green,
was that Tuesday?
Yeah. I got to say, like, it is an elitist thing. I slightly give the Queen a pass because it is the Queen. I feel like, okay, you know, that's part of the job, having lots of horses.
Yeah.
And I do like what a nerd she was about it, because she probably was. She would even have CCTV cameras installed at Sandringham Stud Farm so that she could see the birth of horses. She'd get an alert. She was really invested in it. And also the names are so geeky. So the families of various horses that she had. So there was one called Hypotenuse, who had foals that were called Geometrist, Equal Sum, Longside, Pythagorean. There was Wink of an Eye, who was the son of Momentary, and her mother was Fleeting Memory. So they had all these names. But anyway, they're all being sold off because I think Charles is not as into it. And The Guardian has estimated that if all the horses are sold, it's going to be roughly 27 million that they'll make off the back of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, he still keeps horses, like ceremonial horses, doesn't he? But he just doesn't do the horse racing stuff.
So.
He, in 2024, he appointed Captain Kat Anderson as the first female equerry to a sovereign in history.
Wow.
Progress. Yeah. Progress.
One step at a time, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Something about not touching royals.
Oh, yeah.
I read a newspaper article from the early 20th century, and it said that in 1894, there was a footman of the King of Spain who was in the palace, and young Prince Alfonso was walking across and then fell down some stairs, and this footman caught him and was immediately fired for touching a member of the royal family.
Oh, really?
Let them die. God, yeah. That's the moral. Just let them go. Weird.
Apparently, the Queen Mother then rewarded him with a generous private pension, but he didn't get his job back because the rules were you're just not allowed to touch them.
Gosh.
How many royals have you guys touched?
Not one.
I've met one, but I've not.
You didn't touch?
I didn't touch her, but I met the Queen.
Okay.
Well, I say I met the Queen. I was a student nurse and I was working at the Homerton Hospital in Hackney. Oh. And she came to open a new bit of it was a stroke rehab unit I worked on.
Right.
And it was mad because that day Hackney got tidied up. I've never seen anything like it. There were street sweepers out.
Oh, that's a there job were, and a half, isn't it?
And
that's like,
right?
That's...
Well, just the route that she was going, not all of Hackney, obviously.
Like, oh, these buildings are orange.
But there was
Murder Miles looking very pretty this morning.
All this artwork appeared in the hospital the day before.
Yeah.
And all went again the day after.
Oh,
I really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wherever she went, that art went.
Yeah.
Wow. It's weird. Everywhere I go has the same paintings.
It was like, was it Catherine the Great who had the Potemkin villages that she thought wherever she went, the villages of Russia were so beautiful and stuff because wherever she went, they just built
them up.
And that was a sort of courtier called Potemkin, right? His name was Potemkin and he built these like.
But I wonder if the Queen thought that as well and the King thinks that. It's just like, oh, London's lovely.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. East London is gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah.
The old joke is that everywhere she goes smells of fresh paint. So she thinks that was what the world smells like.
Yes, exactly.
You know?
There was a man came round from the palace the week before she came to teach us how to curtsy if we wanted to curtsy. We didn't have to, but if you wanted to, you could.
Gosh.
And to teach us that it was ma'am rhyme with ham, not mom. But none of us were allowed to take annual leave that day. So we all had to sort of line up. And she did the classic. She stopped in front of, there's me in my uniform and a physiotherapist next to me. And she stopped and looked at me and did the, what do you do? And it's like, well, I'm a nurse.
Not with that hair.
Oh, the entertainment's arrived.
Dan, you wouldn't have asked the question if you hadn't touched a member.
Well, no, I was counting in my head. I'm on four. I'm on four.
You've touched four royals?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was when you were on that island, wasn't it?
Sorry, I've been touched by four. Let me point to the bits they touched. The Queen. I've touched the Queen.
I touched. You were
what? No, you're not
well,
allowed. You're not allowed to touch the Queen.
You can't touch her.
He used to be Royal Equerry.
We shook hands. That's touching.
Are you allowed to shake
her hand?
That's very rare.
What?
That's very rare.
No. Well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's, I mean...
She must have liked you.
Yeah, she must have taken to me.
She only usually does fist bumps, doesn't she?
Since COVID, it's been ever.
Yeah, yeah. No, so I shook hands with the Queen, what? Gave Philip a high five, had a thumb war with Edward. Yeah.
And the old full body with Prince Andrew. Yeah.
Oh, how much of that is true, any of it?
I shook the Queen's hand, I shook Philip's hand, I shook Edward's hand, and then I shook the former Princess of Denmark's hand. But when I was a kid, she was weirdly our neighbour in Hong Kong before she was...
James,
we come
say,
from very different
you're
backgrounds.
You're going to say truth or lie?
Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that the 10th best Formula One driver in the world can't drive. When I say drive, I mean regular cars. He can't drive regular cars. Oh. Now, this was Arvid Lindblad, and he is a very young Formula One driver. He's 18, and he was talking to Max Verstappen, who also started very young. In fact, will be forever the youngest Formula One driver because rules have changed and you have to now be 18 and older. And he was 17 when he was driving. And they were having a chat and he said something about you driving. He said, no, I don't have a license. And so he can sit behind the wheel of a Formula One car, but he can't drive on a regular road.
So do you get a different license
it's
for
a super
Formula
license?
Super
Formula
license.
One. Yeah. So the FIA.
What? Really?
The Fédération Internationale d'Automobile, the FIA, has to... they issue super licenses for Formula One racing. And so Arvid Lindblad and Kimi Antonelli, who drives for Mercedes, he was issued an early super license
What's
as well
point?
In 2024.
What's the point? No one's stopping you and in the middle of a race and saying, excuse me, sir. Do you know how fast you were going back there?
But you can get points on your super license.
Can
and
you?
You can have what? It revoked. Absolutely. Really? So it's a rolling 12 months. So there was a point where, who was it? There was a driver who almost got, because you get a race ban. It might have been Max Verstappen, actually, who had almost 12 points right. within a 12-month period. And if you get that, you get a race ban.
And what is it for?
So it can be if you do something really dangerous, essentially. Oh, so right. if it's something okay. where, because there's normal penalties during racing. So you've got stop-go penalties. You've got like 5-second penalties, 10-second penalties, starting for a grid place penalties. So you start the next race five grid places back from where you qualify and things like that.
Right.
But if you do something really bad, you get points on your
Interesting.
License.
Interesting.
You also get fined for swearing.
You do get fined for swearing.
Even in the car.
There's so many
Inside
weird...
Inside the car?
On the radio, because the radio messages were all broadcast. So they're really...
Yeah.
And it's been because of Mohammed bin Sulayem, who's the head of the F1, he is a, you know, from a Muslim country, etc. So he's been really hot on that. And the drivers really had a backlash against it because they're like, well, you try crashing at, you know, 200 miles an hour and not swearing.
Yeah, it feels like swearing is one thing, but if you're going, fuck! Yeah.
Exactly.
No.
I think they can turn a blind eye to that.
I think you mean flip!
But they
So they brought, sorry, they broadcast these
things. You can hear them
Sometimes.
Talking to yeah. their...
radio. And they actually now have a show you can watch after the broadcast where they play all the...
Oh, you just know, best of.
Like the best of the radio messages.
Something even drier than Formula One.
It's not dry, it's great. A, Formula One isn't dry, but B, the radio messages are so funny
I'm
sometimes.
Teasing.
But they're fighting back. So they have like a driver's association, and the driver's association are saying, you know, if we swear, but it's to make a point as opposed to insulting someone, then that should be fine. So Max Verstappen, who we've mentioned, he was fined for saying his car was fucked during a press conference.
I mean, his car was fucked, but.
There you go. That's,
during a press conference, come on.
Yeah.
One thing I like about this super license is that you have to do a theory test Brilliant. To get it as well, just like a normal license. So yeah, there's a knowledge test which is on the International Sporting Code and F1 Sporting Regulations. And then on top of that, the team has to show that you've driven at a certain speed for a certain number of kilometers in a one-seater car.
Right.
In order for you to get that. And you need to, quite often, you need to have done well in other races that are not Formula One.
I see. You know what I mean? I mean, it all makes sense, doesn't it? Is that, would, I guess, would there be a hazard perception test? there's an elderly lady crossing the road 5 miles ahead of you, but you're going to be on her in 3 seconds. So what are you going to do? So this is an interesting thing about the age. So this guy is very young that we're talking about.
Yes.
The first guy. So there, but there are also, there are very young and there are very old drivers at the moment. Is that right? Somewhere in their 40s?
Fernando Alonso is not 45, that old, just to say. I think.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Lewis Hamilton's 41 now, I think.
Yeah, but that's it's a really big range within the sport. Mm. And I think the oldest ever Formula One champion was Juan Manuel Fangio of Argentina. Mm. And so he was ages ago, he was racing. It was in the 50s.
Yeah.
And he did his last one in 1957, age 46 years old, was, I think, his last victory. And when he started, I just love it. I mean, because obviously Formula One is so technical, it's amazingly complicated. There are incredibly clever teams working on, you know, how to make the cars more aerodynamic and all of this. When he was doing his racing, helmets were made of cloth until 1952.
Oh, yeah.
And helmets were made compulsory that year, and they were made of papier-mâché, I read.
Oh.
I know, the pie-shaped helmets. Okay. You would get covered in soot inside your car because just the cars are much more basic and you weren't protected. And of course, people died by the dozen every single year.
Yeah.
But, well, I love looking at the photographs from like 1950s race, because 1950, so it's 75 years of Formula One last year. And there was a great exhibition I went to. And you look at the photos of the drivers from the 50s and they're fat. Like, and since, you know, in modern Formula One cars with the monocoque chassis and things, they're tiny drivers, F1. They're like jockeys.
Are they?
Because it's a tiny space they have to sit in. And you want them light because obviously you don't want them to weigh down the car. You've got a weight limit for the car. And it's just these fat blokes with beer bellies and fags. And I just like, you just don't see that in Formula One now. It's brilliant. We look at those old pictures.
I found a list of all the people who have ever raced in Formula One. Paddy Driver.
Brilliant.
Participated in 2 races, scoring no points. Oh. Scott Speed was the first American driver to race in Formula One since Michael Andretti. That was in 2006. Hans Stuck was a German guy. He was really interesting because he was friends with Hitler. And then after the war, if you were German, you weren't allowed to be in Formula One. And that's because you needed to be a member of a society. And after the war, you weren't allowed new clubs in Germany. No one was allowed to join a club.
Right.
And Formula One club, which you would need to join your international authority, you weren't allowed to have them. So he then went to Austria and he said, oh, no, I'm Austrian. So I'm going to drive for them instead.
That's very interesting.
One thing I was reading about, because I do find it quite exciting to watch Formula One. But one thing I think I'd be more excited to watch is the pre-season testing of Formula One, because this is where the cars are making, in some cases, their debut with new mechanics and new things. But they try and hide what that is before the actual start of the Formula
Sandbagging.
One.
Sandbagging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's all these different methods that they use. So, for example, you remember those ships that were supposedly black and white and all those
The Dazzle
ships. They do that with Formula One cars so that you can't quite spot where they might have rearranged certain positions.
Oh.
Or they'll change all the stickers so you think the exhaust is in one spot, but actually it's in another. They try as much as they can to disguise it just so you don't get what they've done to their new cars. But on top of that, if they've signed a new rookie or if someone's trying to make a comeback, what they'll often do is they'll have one of their existing drivers lend their helmet. And so they'll walk out.
I thought you were going to say Mission Impossible style rubber masks. That's a shame.
Well, they might be wearing full.
It might be under the helmet, but a bit pointless.
Just in case. No, but they'll go out in the helmet of another driver so that they think, oh, it's just him doing his test. But it's someone.
Well, Lewis Hamilton's 6 inches shorter this year. That's weird. I wonder what he's done by.
You would have to find someone whose head was the same size, though, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Once you're in a monocoque, though. I suppose
that,
they
the
just do the design. That's the sort of what you're sat in, the bit around you. But the pre-season testing was really interesting this year because there's been a big rule change in Formula One this year. So from 2022 up till 2025, they had ground effect cars. So with really high downforce, low floors. Mm. And there's been a complete rule change now. So basically, the reason engine manufacturers put lots of money into Formula One is because it is a way of sort of testing things for road cars and to advertise their road cars and everything in the future. So there's always, Formula One car development has to sort of mirror in some ways what's happening on the road.
Right.
And like proper Formula One fans don't really want that because we want big old stinking V8 engines you know, make that lovely noise that make your ears pop.
You don't want the cars to have to plug in every 45 miles.
Exactly. That's, I mean, I don't know if you've watched Formula E, but it's really tedious. So, but this year's rule change.
Andy, calm down, Andy.
Some of us enjoy watching fast chargers doing their thing, okay?
So the cars this now have this sort of energy recovery system. So it's all about, they can harvest energy when they're braking and then employ it.
They've all got batteries as well.
They've been, the hybrid era has been since 2014 or so. Right, okay. So they had, before that, from 2009, you had the KERS system, which was the kinetic energy recovery system. And then that sort of evolved. Because the thing is, if you make the car too efficient, you don't get overtakes and that's boring.
I see.
You overtakes are the things you want. So they're constantly changing the rules to try and get more overtakes. There is a button now that they can press called the overtake button, which just means they can use that energy they've harvested to boost an overtake. So when they use that function,
like
this overtake
a nitro
button
is it a,
basically, yeah. Yeah, like it's like
love
Mario
it.
Kart.
Like your love bullet it. In yeah. Mario Kart, yeah. You just
and
all
it,
the
and
way.
It looks like that. It just, when they press it and it just overtakes, it looks like they're completely different formulas. Like they're just, oh, okay. Wow.
Have they considered adding like shells and bananas?
More people would watch. I think even Andy would watch.
The KERS thing that you mentioned, obviously that, or not obviously, but that's now in all electric cars, basically. Yeah. So the reason, one of the reasons you get so far on your in your electric car without charging is because it can regain energy from the braking system. And that began in Formula One.
Mm.
Yes. The Formula One drivers, they do all the, you know, they do lots of training, obviously, because it's much more physical than it used to be. Mm. I didn't know this. What's the most important thing for a Formula One driver to practice?
Their neck muscles.
It's neck day. So when you're driving this car and you're going around the corners and you're whizzing along and all of that, supposedly your head weighs 5 times what it normally does, partly the helmet and partly the gravitational forces acting on you.
Yeah.
And so often they can't buy normal clothes because they've got this whacking great neck, basically.
It's a real look to Formula One drivers. They're small with these massive
They're all
necks.
Neck.
And headbangers, these, people who love metal music.
Headbangers would make great Formula One drivers because they're doing all this training. So, and the images of them training their necks are so funny because they'll release shots sometimes of them wearing this mad brace. You sort of big, like one of those helmets you'd wear for a psychiatric experiment, you know, but like with a thick rubber cord coming off it. And at the other end of the rubber cord is a trainer who is just hauling their neck over in one direction and they're trying to resist it.
Oh, that I get mirror touch synesthesia. When I look at that, that makes my neck hurt.
Same. Wow. It's really sad.
Yeah, they're so strong and fit now. Like, they sweat so much. They lose so much weight during a race. And particularly in the really, like Singapore or places where it's really hot. Mm. And they're, so they have water to drink in the car. They have a water system. But what I think people don't realise is the water is right by the engine. Mm. And so after a couple of laps, it's basically like tea. It's like hot water they have to drink. Damon Hill did once have tea in his, famously. And another great Damon Hill fact, if you want it, played a guitar solo on a Def Leppard track.
What?
Damon Hill. So I grew up at Brands Hatch, basically. I was there every week. Both my parents worked there, and that's why I love motorsport, particularly Formula One. And I can remember going in. The Kentagon is the name of the pub at Brands Hatch. So it's a Pentagon, and it's in Kent. See what
Beautiful.
They've done?
Brilliant. And, that's so good.
And I can remember after races going in there and him and his band playing.
Really?
Yeah.
What's Def Leppard again?
A band.
No, as in what genre are they?
Oh, like sort of hair rock, really.
Rock. So probably some good headbanging for Damon.
That's why. And there's also, I'm quite interested in female Formula One drivers.
Oh, yeah.
There have been female drivers in Formula One. There's only ever been one female driver score points in a Formula One race, and that was Lella Lombardi. She was an Italian driver, and it was in 1975, and she scored half a point. And that was because if a race is less than 60% complete, you only get half the points. And she and during the race there were fatalities, unfortunately. There was a German driver who crashed into a spectator pit, and there was a fireman and a couple of journalists and a spectator were killed. So it was, you know, pretty. Mm, wow. But she scored half a point. So,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
So she's the only person to ever score points. But there's loads of really, a little shout out to Alicia Pomosky at the moment, who's a Red Bull driver. She's got her first pole last week in the F1 Academy. So there's lots of women drivers coming through now. So hopefully in the next 10 years, we'll see another.
Yeah, very exciting.
Because also you think like smaller in general, on average. So like you get lots of female jockeys, for instance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
part of the problem is, which is always part of the problem with Formula One, is money. Because you have different type, you know, some people get their seats in Formula One on merit purely. And some get their seats in Formula One because they also bring money. So Lance Stroll, for example, who drives for Aston Martin, a pretty terrible Formula One driver. And there's lots of people much more deserving of that seat. But his dad owns the team.
Mm.
What are you going to do? Yeah. He basically bought the team for his son to have a seat in Formula One. Right.
The thing is, you want a nice egalitarian sport like polo. That's
exactly,
what you really
that's what
need
you
to
need.
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that in 16th century London, there was a chain of pubs that sold laxatives on tap. any questions?
So many.
So the 16th century, so this is Queen Elizabeth could have gone to one of these pubs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, in fact, this person who made them, Dr. William Butler, he was a physician to James the First.
Oh,
really?
So only just after her, in fact.
Wow.
And he was definitely around at that time. I'm not sure how often Queen Elizabeth went to the pub.
Probably not much.
Not that much.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm.
But he was a physician, and he became famous for various reasons we might go into. But one of the things he did was make this thing called purging ale, which had aniseed, caraway, licorice, and beer. And if you went to quite a lot of pubs in London, you would be able to get it on tap. And it was good for you because you would purge your body. It was medicinal, let's say.
So was it in a beer?
It was like sort beer, but with all this extra
stuff in it to make you shit yourself.
Like, imagine a nice cask pale ale that you would get today, but with a few, what's the opposite of Imodium?
he's like a original hipster brewery kind of character, isn't he?
I'd rather that than syrup of figs. I think it sounds quite nice.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, there's still a pub in London called Old Dr. Butler's Head in Moorgate, which claims to be associated with him and that he sold his beer in that pub.
Right.
Now, the actual truth is we're not even certain if he made the beer himself. It was definitely named after him and he was definitely a physician, but it could be that he was just so famous that they called it his beer.
Yeah.
So we're not sure about that.
Some pubs had his portrait hung up, but again, it might have been just associated with a famous doctor.
Sort of license his name.
Yeah.
He's a really interesting chap, this guy. Yeah. So he went to Clare College, Cambridge and did an arts degree. And then for some reason managed to get a physician's license. And it's not not certain how he got it. They seem to have just given it to him. And he just worked at an apothecary shop for ages in Cambridge. And then one day a local clergyman had fallen into an opium-induced coma and been given up for dead. And Butler killed a cow, put the priest inside the cow, and the priest was cured. And from that moment, he became famous.
It's going to wake you up being put in a cow, isn't it, I think?
Or it's going to make the opium-induced trip even wilder.
So cut the cow open?
He cut a cow open in, like, is it The Revenant, where he kind of lives inside a bear?
Yes, he does.
A bit like that.
My dog on the beach once, she was running towards something. She's a little cockapoo. I'm like, what's she running? And she climbed inside a seal carcass.
Oh.
The smell, I can still smell it now when I think
about it. Oh my God.
That's a bath.
Absolutely. And she was so proud of herself, you know.
That's amazing.
A real career defining moment, I think, the placing a patient inside a cow.
He was 68 at that stage, and we see basically nothing of him throughout the whole of history from his birth until this moment. And then suddenly at the age of 68, he becomes nationally famous, and so much so that King James the First had a hunting injury, and he said, "Get me the cow guy."
Because if the clergyman had died, I don't think you can recover from that. Going,
but so what did you do? But what's he got to lose? It sounds like he's not made a big success of his career so far.
He's doing fine.
Yeah, but yeah, okay.
If he died, wouldn't you just take him out of the car and pretend you never did it?
I think you'd have to. Yeah,
it was like that when I got here.
I read somewhere they called him an empiric physician.
Oh, yeah.
Which meant he based his treatments not on any theory, but purely on reasoning and experience. That's
yeah.
That's not what you want from your doctor, is it? You want them to have read some books.
I guess yeah. so, ideally. Yeah. He had a few weird things. If someone came to him with epilepsy, he would shoot a couple of firearms close to their heads to scare the condition out of them.
Yep. It's like getting rid of the hiccups, isn't it?
If someone had ague, which I guess is, what is ague? It's
fever?
Like malaria kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, but he would push them into the Thames, because like cold water therapy. I mean, you still do cold water therapy today.
Yeah. Wim Hof method, he was pioneered.
That's the thing. Butler was there before them all.
Yeah. I read one thing he did where there was a patient who had catarrh, severe catarrh.
Oh, yeah.
What's that?
Flap nose, but
heavy sort of matter on the lungs.
A sniffle
kind of thing.
A sniffle.
No, it's more. It's sort of a heavy, chesty, a really chesty thing condition,
yeah.
right?
Okay.
And Butler said, right, you've got to smoke an ounce of tobacco, which is a lot. And it took the patient 25 pipes of tobacco, one after the other. Very much like a parent catching you smoking one cigarette and making you... But apparently that completely cured the patient. I mean, some citation needed, I think. Didn't come back for 17 years, didn't it?
I mean, died of lung disease, but didn't have a cold anymore. That was the most important thing.
Well, this is the 1500s. I mean, it's probably in line with what lot of doctors were practicing or trying or testing at the time. Mm. I got this new method with the cow.
Well,
oh, great.
He was a spicy fellow when you disagreed with him. He was quite something, Butler. So he got involved in a gold clipping affair. So that is where, you know, coins are made of gold. And if you clip off a little bit of the edge, you've suddenly got this. You've still got the coin, but you've got the gold as well. Fantastic, you know?
Yeah.
And if you do that, you can make it big. It's a
and that's why we have the edges on a pound coin.
Exactly.
Like Isaac Newton supposedly put those on.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Like, so, to stop people from clipping them.
Exactly. So someone from, he was in Cambridge. He was practicing in Cambridge, wasn't he? And someone from Trinity College, Cambridge, a senior called Paul Thompson, was sentenced to death for this crime. Because it was incredibly serious at the time. Interfering with the currency, big no-no. Butler wrote to him, I just love this. Okay, this is the quote he sent to him. He just wrote to him saying, oh, you've been sentenced to death and you've been caught doing this. Well, I've got a letter from Butler. Maybe that'll cheer me up. Butler wrote, your giddy-headed, fantastic fiddling fingers and scribbling pen, directed by the motion of your quicksilver brain, without penitency, pretending piety, practicing policy, will bring you to a violent end. As you have always lived a conceited wizard, so now you will die, a ninny hammer fool.
Oh, wow.
Yes!
Whoa. It's the next Hamilton.
Burn!
Yeah.
Yeah.
A ninny hammer fool.
Ninny
hammer.
I love that there was lots of plosives at the top there as well.
Oh, yeah.
That was very good for testing a mic. That.
Absolutely.
It's quite nice that there's a pub still named after him, because the connection, it seems, is that you could buy this laxative on tap there. But actually, he was known to basically be in the pub all the time getting pissed. And he had an assistant called Nell. And Nell did a few things, but Nell's chief job was to go and collect him at the end of the night, drunk from the pub, and sort of wheel him home in a wheelbarrow or carry him or whatever method he needed.
How many pints of laxative ale have you had? Not many. Well, haven't you?
The trousers tell a different story.
Oh, dear.
I've got something about, because I was really fascinated by the fact it was laxative ale.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole sort of brewing, because you know it was women who first brewed beer, so you had your alewives would.
Yeah,
and there's
yeah.
something called groaning ale. I don't know if you've heard of this.
No, what's that?
Groaning ale, so when a woman was pregnant, a local alewife, so one of these local brewing women, would brew a batch of really strong ale for when she went into labour. And when she went into labour, both her and the midwife would drink the really strong ale to help the whole process.
Wow.
I think that's something they should bring back.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Not the midwife, though. I'm not sure about that.
It's true. Well, this was the thing. So beer at the time, and we're talking like ages ago now, I mean sort of medieval, was home-brewed. and you might put a pole above your door just saying you've got ale. And so
if, I like that. You've got ale.
Ale. Oh my God. That's that, it.
That's a rom-com we need to make.
That's really good. That's really good.
Angela Barnes stars in You've Got Ale.
I'm game. Quick, somebody write that up.
And so that and there were bride ales as well as the groaning ales. You know, an ale was almost an event as well as an actual drink itself. And then the Black Death happened and a third of the population died. I mean, just absolutely devastating for everybody. But it led to this big labour shortage. Peasants suddenly got much better pay because they were so much scarcer. Yeah. You know, the work
you needed someone to work on your farm, but everyone was dead. So you could
So in union terms and labour terms, it was a brilliant thing, the Black Death. But standards of living went up, and that led to more permanent alehouses because there was a bit more surplus supply, as it were, and that led to kind of better food and better drink and more leisure, and that was kind of the beginning of pub culture.
It's really this idea of the whole binge Britain thing. I find quite interesting because we've always been known as a nation of drinkers.
Yes.
So from the 8th century, St. Boniface, a missionary from Devon, travelled Europe, and he wrote to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Cuthbert, and he says, "In your diocese, the vice of drunkenness is too frequent. This is an evil peculiar to pagans and to our race. Neither the Franks, nor the Gauls, nor the Lombards, nor the Romans, nor the Greeks commit it." So we've always been...
Come on, the Greeks.
Yeah, right? They had other things more that they were doing. The Greeks. I love it. And and I read some really good statistics. Like I can't remember when this was now. I should have written it down. But it was St. Bartholomew's Hospital. Their records show that at one point, sick children averaged 3 pints of beer a day.
Wow.
For the sick children.
How similar is beer now as it was then?
So it was weaker at the time.
It would have been
weaker.
So
was it changed when hops came along.
Yeah.
So that was a bit later.
And I think it was the idea that it had been through a brewing process and it was safer.
Safer than just drinking straight out of the river. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
So it is, there's a good reason behind it, basically.
It wasn't
small beer, they call it.
Small beer.
In 2020, Pennsylvania designated beer distributors as a life sustaining service.
I could care.
And the idea is that because the people who take the beer around also often provide water, soda, and some food/snacks. So in some areas of the state, according to communications director Casey Smith, in some areas of the state, there might be the only place where you can move water around is by moving beer at the same
Absolutely.
Time.
Pork scratchings are actually one of the four food groups. It's very important.
Does anyone else really want a beer? Let's
wrap up and grab a beer. Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we've said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found online. I'm on @Schreiberland on Instagram. James?
My Instagram is no such thing as James Harkin.
Andy?
@AndrewHunterM.
Angela, where can we find you?
@Angela_Barnsey on Instagram.
Nice. And you're on tour now, not with one show, but two.
Two shows. So I'm finishing off my tour, Angst, which finishes at the end of May. And then from June to the end of the year, I'm hosting The Archers live at 75, which I'm so excited about because I'm such an Archers nerd.
That's a radio show in the UK for international listeners, and it's brilliant. Yeah, if you want to get through to us as a group, podcast@qi.com, send all of your emails there. If you want to send us your favorite facts, Andy will go through the inbox, cherry pick the best, and bring them to our bonus episode, which goes out every Monday called Little Fish. So send them in there. But if you've got general feedback that you want us to know about, also send that, because Andy picks the best of those for our behind the scenes mailbag episode, which is called Drop Us a Line. And that's part of Club Fish, which is our private members club. You'll find it on Patreon. So just head to patreon.com/clubfish. And there's multiple tiers there of things that you can do. So you can join the Drop Us a Line as an audio. There's also a higher tier where you can get it as a video. And then at the highest tier, you become custodian of one of our headline facts from the last 12 years of Fish. So much stuff there. Check it all out. We've also got a quiz coming up. That's April the 14th. And if you become a member of the highest tier of Club Fish, you can get access to that too. And just a reminder, that's patreon.com/clubfish. Otherwise, hey, come back next week because we're going to be back with another episode and we will see you then. Goodbye.